Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare tells us about research designed to increase the viability of eggs during in vitro fertilization. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has a health challenge on his hands. Half of the population of the most populous city in the nation is either obese or overweight, and Mayor Bloomberg recently announced a bold new action to attack the problem, at least on one front. In a controversial move, the mayor announced a citywide ban on the sale of large-sized sugary drinks, including sodas, sports drinks, and pre-sweetened iced teas. The sale of any sweetened drink larger than 16 ounces will be banned at the city's restaurants, food carts, movie theaters, and sporting arenas, venues that are governed by the New York City Department of Health. The city's health commissioner, Dr. Thomas Farley, blames the accelerated consumption of sweetened drinks over the past 30 years for half of the city's obesity problems. And the problem is even more pronounced in areas with higher concentrations of poverty and reliance on food stamps. Bloomberg is no stranger to controversial measures to deal with matters of public health, which he has made a priority of his administration. He is responsible for measures that have banned the sale of food with unhealthy trans fats. He is also behind a ban on smoking in public restaurants. These New York City-based public health policies have been adopted by municipalities across the country, creating a lasting impact on the health of other communities. Mayor Bloomberg has been trying to find ways to make soda consumption less appealing, including a higher tax on sugary drinks that failed in Albany. This measure will only require the approval of the Health Commission, all of whom are Bloomberg appointees. So it is expected to pass and could go into effect as soon as March of next year. A bold public policy initiative aimed at greatly reducing the consumption of a product that has contributed to poorer public health that could inspire other municipalities across the country to do the same. Now that's a bright idea. Today we're speaking with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, co-founder of One Mind for Research, an organization founded to create a public-private global partnership of healthcare providers and researchers to combat all disease and disorders of the brain. Congressman Kennedy, the youngest son of the late Senator Ted Kennedy, has spent a lifetime in public service. Having been elected to the Rhode Island State Legislature at the age of 21, he also spent 16 years in Congress as a member of the House of Representatives, leaving in 2010 to launch this new initiative. Congressman Kennedy, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be with you.
You know, you launched One Mind for Research as a far-reaching initiative that you've called a moonshot for the mind. I think it's 50 years ago that your uncle, President John F. Kennedy, introduced to the country the concept of that we can land a man on the moon. And I think he eloquently put it that back then that we're not doing it because it's easy. We're doing it because it's hard. And certainly mental illness and diseases of the brain are so complex and varied and still so little is known about them. Tell us what prompted you to launch this One Mind initiative. And how is this organization different from brain disease research programs that are already out there?
Well, thank you for having me on, and thank you for helping to bring greater transparency and dialogue into the whole issue of healthcare. Healthcare is not an issue. It's personal to every family in America who has a loved one that's suffering. And I believe that we want to get to cures and therapies faster. And because we have our loved ones whose lives are on the line, and we know that medical research can make a big difference in securing greater discoveries and therapies that will transform their lives and allow them to live much more productive and fulfilling lives. I believe that the answers are political. I think science is doing a great job, but if science is organized in a way that can maximize all the discoveries that are going on to the benefit of all, because keep in mind, we're researching the same organ. It's the brain. And yet in politics, what organizes science is disease. So schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, autism, depression, addiction, they all have different constituencies, and they all advocate for research. And ultimately, if they work together, there's going to be an advancement for everybody, because what's found in discovering one disorder of the brain is going to help unlock the mysteries of a different disorder. Much like when we went to outer space, we discovered new galaxies simply by our exploration. Now it's time for us to explore the galaxies of neurons in inner space. And I think JFK's kind of aspirational goal can serve to unite our mission, because keep in mind, historians and people who were there at the time will acknowledge that it was a very aspirational goal to put a man on the moon, return him, before the decade was out. Today, we are obviously a long ways off from researching and discovering so many of the maladies that occur because of when the brain isn't working properly. And, you know, I think that we can get to the solutions quicker than we might imagine if we organize ourselves differently. And much like the moonshot was a national security issue, I believe saving our soldiers from traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress is going to unlock the answers for every American who is suffering from a brain-related disorder. And in fact, we're going to lead the world if we do this research, because these are diseases that know no geographical boundary. They're around the world. And wouldn't it be great if the United States led the way in helping to tackle one of the greatest challenges that all of humanity faces, and that's the crippling effect of not only a disorder of the brain, from dementia to addiction, but in fact the stigma that comes from suffering from such a disorder. So I believe science is going to give us the two answers we need. One, the medical answer, but two, the new attitude that these are medical advances. They're not moral issues, as is often our society's response to treating these conditions as kind of moral failures of the individual who's suffering from a brain disorder.
Well, Congressman Kennedy, this is certainly one of those things that come across rarely, which is big, bold, brilliant, and audacious in what you're trying to accomplish. And there's so many threads in what you've just said that we're going to want to hold on. But let me start with one that maybe lets you lay out for our listeners something of just the scope and the dimension of what we're trying to do here. Because while I think there's probably not a family in America that hasn't been affected by one of the conditions you talked about, I'm not sure that people realize what a toll in combination they take on the country in terms of social and economic impact. I wonder if you'd like to speak to that for a moment before we pull on some of the other threads that you raised.
Well, clearly, as I mentioned, these are, by all accounts, the biggest burden of illness in terms of economic and social impact, and that has been shown through study after study. But for any family that's had a loved one that's been suffering from one of these brain-related illnesses, they know that the impact cannot be measured in economic terms alone. They know the personal toll on not only the individual, their dignity, but that of the family, and the sense of shame that comes from having suffered from one of these illnesses, I think is so pervasive. And we need to liberate ourselves from this stigma. And frankly, the research that was done on behalf of, or I should say inspired by, my Aunt Rosemary, that my Aunt Eunice started in order to better understand intellectual disabilities, ultimately was research that is going to provide answers for another member of my Aunt Eunice's family, and that's all of her children, because her late husband, my Uncle Sarge, died of Alzheimer's. And now that is a disease that's facing all of her five children. But ironically, the research to help us understand dementia did not come out of the institute at the NIH that studies aging. It came out of the Institute on Children, because we studied through the NICHD issues of those with intellectual disabilities. And guess what? We've understood the fundamentals of dementia as it relates to people with Down syndrome. And ironically, by doing the research on people with Down syndrome, we've better understood the mechanisms that are going to help us answer the challenge of Alzheimer's. We don't know where the answers are going to come from. If we're studying the brain, we need to think a lot more holistically. There are mechanisms of the brain, and if we understand the mechanisms, we'll understand a lot of diseases all at once.
You know, you mentioned just a minute ago, Congressman, that you're trying to really organize the science and sort of marshal the troops, if you will, which brings me to the fact that you've brought on a new CEO for One Mind for Research, Army General Peter Chiarelli, who's really been a dedicated advocate for removing the stigma associated with PTSD and other brain disorders suffered by soldiers. So I guess he both has the organizational skill, but also understands the issues that you've been talking about or the stigma that's associated with this issue. Tell us a little bit about the role that General Chiarelli is tackling around the issues and also how he plans to orchestrate the work that you're leading.
Well, if you look at history, you understand that we accomplished amazing feats of scientific endeavor, and it was all driven by national security. So the Manhattan Project was driven by World War II. Obviously, we built our interstate highway system under Eisenhower in response to the Cold War and the need for us to be able to move our country around. And of course, the moonshot was driven by kind of a national security race to be number one in terms of space in a Cold War paradigm. Ultimately, our country really knows how to organize itself if it's an issue of national security. And today, as you know, in Washington, very little gets done. And the exception to that rule is if it's for veterans and soldiers. So the GI Bill was passed, the tax credit for employment for veterans was passed in this last 2 years. You know, these are initiatives that are emblematic of the fact that Republicans and Democrats work together for our soldiers. And I believe that one of the ways that we can galvanize and organize ourselves for science is to do so politically. And I believe that the most powerful argument is making sure that those young men and women who sacrificed for all of us, and if the, quote, signature wound of this latest war, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, if the signature wound is traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress, then what we ought to be about is making sure that we solve these challenges that come from injury of the brain, because if we do it for our soldiers, frankly, all Americans are going to benefit from it, because frankly, as we know in this environment, medical research doesn't get much support, even though it is a national priority. I believe that we can put research where it needs to be, and that's as a top priority.
So, Congressman, let's talk about this ambitious goal at One Mind for Research of coalescing all the silos of brain disease research into one central clearinghouse of research data that can then be used to tackle all of the conditions. Now, your organization has created a couple of programs, I understand, one, a knowledge integration network for traumatic brain injury, and another, a centralized database called the One Voice Biorepository. Tell us more about these brain data exchange portals, maybe who some of the partner organizations are, and do patients have an opportunity to contribute data directly to this?
What modern day informatics, i.e., you know, kind of Watson, you know, what it provides for us that was really a discovery of going to outer space, these supercomputers, what they provide for us in doing research in brain science is an ability to connect the dots. So if we develop standard common data elements, if you will, to describe research in one area of disease research, and we can make that research comparable to other areas, what we learn is that there are patterns. And if we can recognize the patterns in one area of brain science that are similar to patterns in another area, then we can get closer to a cure, and we don't have to repeat the same science. So you asked about how advocates can be involved. I believe that ultimately advocates are going to be the best partners in science, because science won't be able to advance if we don't empower both families as well as consumers to enlist in this effort. The scientists can only work as effectively as the consumers will allow them to be partners. And what we're trying to do with One Mind is not do the science, but help facilitate the science in the way that we organize the way it's done.
We're speaking today with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, co-founder of One Mind for Research, which is calling for a unified approach to mental health research, shifting the focus away from individual brain disease, focus instead on the whole brain itself. You know, I want to remind our listeners that, Congressman, one of your many achievements while in Congress was that you co-sponsored the mental health parity bill, which passed in 2008. And this bill, which you passionately lobbied for in the halls of Congress, was created to provide protection for people dealing with mental health issues, as well as ensuring that they not be denied access to care. Talk to us a little bit about the impact that the Affordable Care Act will have on mental health services and parity in our country.
Well, first, let me say that the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act is the law. And no matter what the Supreme Court says about the health care law, parity still will stand. Ultimately, the only way we're going to see the end of discrimination towards people who suffer from brain-related illnesses is if they are empowered and their families to enforce this law. So like civil rights, it comes down to enforcement. If healthcare moves forward, that strengthens our approach to treat the whole person through holistic care and not allowing insurance companies to discriminate. The best thing that advocates can do who care about this issue is to get involved in making sure their state insurance commissioner, in addition to the federal HHS that are in charge of implementing this law and enforcing it, that we stand up for ourselves. We need to make sure our family and friends who are suffering from brain illnesses do not end up going back to the back of the bus because an insurance company or our system says they're not worthy of first-class healthcare, and it'll only change if people demand that it changes.
I also want to acknowledge that you've just set such huge goals for yourself, including financial goals, in order to be able to do the work that One Mind for Research has set out to do. And you've talked about the lack of financial resources that are made available for brain disorder research, even as we have so much promise on the horizon. So tell us, what are your plans to galvanize the financial, philanthropic, institutional, governmental support that you need to continue to drive these research efforts forward?
Well, first of all, I recognize we're in very difficult times, but I also recognize that you'll never get it unless you ask.
Right.
You know, yep. And first and foremost, we need to ask. And I believe that every family in America has a child with autism or a parent or aunt or uncle with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, or a sister or brother with depression or addiction. I think that if we define what the ask is from both the federal government, from corporate America, from the international community, that we'll get to what we want a lot quicker than if we kind of muddle through this and hope something's going to happen. I believe that the money is there, because I believe that the interest is there. But I believe you don't get the money if you don't define what you're going to use it for and why that money is going to be invested in something that's going to produce huge dividends for every family and for our economy and for the world. And if we're not clear, you can bet it's a lot easier for political leaders and elected leaders to ignore us if we're not organized and if we're not clear in what we want. And so that's what my hope is.
Congressman Kennedy, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation in brain research that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
Well, I think that the combination of knowing what the genomic research, what our genes tell us in terms of what we are likely to be at high risk for, just much like cancer or any other illness, that we now need to know how our experiences either shape the genes or affect the genes. And so we need to get the whole area of social science and experiential kind of narrative of stories about our own lives and marry that with the new science of genomics and be able to get a better answer as to why in some people their genes are set off to have a particular brain-related illness, whereas for other people, those genes do not get turned on and the illnesses do not end up affecting the people. So I think it's a fascinating area of science because it's combining a lot of areas of knowledge and painting a bigger picture. And ultimately, this picture will be clearer if we connect the dots. And that's why, as I mentioned before, the science of informatics and big data is going to be so crucial in this effort.
We've been speaking today with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, co-founder of One Mind for Research, a global public-private partnership to bring together the best science, technology, and expertise to accelerate research in diseases of the brain to generate new diagnostics, treatments, and cures. Congressman Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
It's been wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Arianne O'Hare with this tech report. It's been 34 years since Louise Brown, the first test tube baby, was born. And the process has, as they say, come a long way, baby. But the procedure of harvesting eggs, fertilizing them in a petri dish, and planting the embryos into a mother for gestation are still fraught with a high degree of uncertainty.
Only about 6% of the eggs, they end up being a baby.
And that, says Yale Fertility Center Director Dr. Pasquale Patrizio, means there's lots of room for improvement. Because implantation isn't always predictable. Multiple embryos are often implanted, leading to higher incidence of multiple births. And complications are a problem, too. Researchers at Yale University and the University of Oxford in England have honed in on something they think will dramatically improve the egg selection process. They've zeroed in on the chromosomal makeup of the human egg. The team at Yale and Oxford discovered you could analyze the cells surrounding the egg, so-called cumulus cells, and know exactly whether or not the chromosomal balance inside the egg was viable.
So we discovered that cumulus cells that are associated with eggs that are not normal, they have a couple of genes that are expressed, though they are present in a different concentration.
Yale Fertility Center Director Dr. Pasquale Patrizio says this discovery is a game changer, especially in older women undergoing IVF who have a higher number of eggs with abnormal numbers of chromosomes. Now scientists can analyze the enzymes on the outside of the eggs and determine pretty specifically which ones are the good eggs.
Right now, you're able to analyze the egg by doing a biopsy of the egg. Well, if we take the cells that are usually discarded and we can apply a colorimetric test to these cells, you don't even need to manipulate the eggs at all.
Another benefit to improving the outcome of IVF procedures, it also reduces the moral and ethical problem of harvesting embryos in high-risk multiple birth scenarios, as well as ending a pregnancy due to potential birth defects that are life-threatening. I'm Arianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.